You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast covering the 1st to the 7th of January edition, the first issue review of 2015. Happy New Year. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Holly Else and Chris Havergal and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. The 2014 Research Excellence Framework shouldn't be allowed to impoverish the humanities and the social sciences after medicine and life sciences scored particularly well in the exercise. Holly will have more on that in a second. You might think that making unconditional offers to students would improve a university's ability to recruit said students. Well, think again, UCAS figures suggest otherwise, as we'll find out shortly. And the Committee of University Chairs has published a new version of its Higher Education Code of Governance. That was a little while ago, but John's been digging into it, and he will be taking us through that in just a moment too. But first, unsurprisingly, we're still studying the impact of the 2014 REF. It's the subject of this week's Splash, Holly, specifically fears for the humanities and social sciences.
Yeah, so this is the story that looks at how each of the four panels in the REF did. Each panel covers different subject areas. Main panel A, which is the medical and life sciences research panel, has pretty much outperformed the other three panels, which cover physical sciences, social science and arts and humanities. In terms of the quality of the research that that has been submitted to it. So it's sort of got the most four-star research, lots of different reasons for this. Some people saying it's to do with the fact that impact, which is one of the new criteria for assessment in this exercise, is perhaps easier to show in medical research. Well, obviously there's an immediate impact of people getting treatments or therapies. But one of the other suggested reasons for this is that in 2006, before the assessment period started, Dame Sally Davis, who was director of research and development in the NHS at the time, established something called the National Institute for Health Research, which gives away about £1 billion a year for the medical and applied clinical sciences. And the whole purpose of this money is to transform research into outputs for patients. So this could have boosted the whole area of life sciences in this time. And so some people say, is this really fair? Because other subjects, arts and humanities in particular, which didn't do so well, may not have all this funding.
And it's important, isn't it? Because when it comes to funding, the sort of quality-related funding or QR funding is tied quite strictly to how well it's performed, and I guess the fear is that that money will go not to areas that perhaps need it.
It's all important to say at this point that the exact funding formula, how the money will be distributed, is not really known at this time. It could be tweaked, but at the moment it's sort of, in the previous exercise it was a certain amount of money for each subject, so one set of subjects doing particularly well wouldn't necessarily skew the figures, but there's no reason to say that model will happen this time.
Yeah, needless to say, we'll be following, I'd imagine, that funding development pretty closely.
Yeah, it just should be interesting to see what happens. I mean, there's also a small analysis at the bottom of the page about how the regional alliances of universities did geographically compared to each other, which makes some interesting reading.
Yeah, page six, bottom of the page, page six, if you've got the magazine all online at timeshighereducation.co.uk as well. Our cover feature is also on REF, Paul Jump. Looks at the research intensity REF rankings, so another 20-odd pages of analysis and tables. We've also got a REF panel member, Willie Maley. He's reflecting on his experience as a REF panel member in our opinion section, and that's also well worth checking out. Also, we've got a REF homepage on our site. You'll find it just by going along there. Type REF into the search bar, and you'll be able to see all of our coverage, which is pretty comprehensive. But away from REF, Chris, you've been looking at student recruitment. Surely unconditional offers are the way to go if you want to increase student numbers at your university.
That's what you'd think, and certainly they're one of a number of symptoms of increased competition between universities that show up in the end-of-cycle report from UCAS for 2014 entry. That report shows more offers being made by universities, suggests that the entry grades for some of the more selective universities maybe falling slightly. And also, as part of it, yes, it shows a fourfold increase in the number of unconditional offers made by universities. Clearly, it would seem the reason it would appear that some of them are doing that is because they think that it would improve their ability to recruit students. Until now, there hasn't really been an attempt, certainly on a sector-wide basis, to analyse whether that's the case. That's what UCAS has now done, not by comparing whether unconditional offers are more likely to be accepted sort of at individual institutions than conditional offers, but by tracking over time the recruitment performance of institutions when they, in the first year, start to make a large number of unconditional offers. They're able to do that because it's thought to be quite a small number of providers, maybe just 5 to 10 institutions, that are actually responsible for this overall explosion in the use of unconditional offers. The findings are an interesting one. Tracking the performance of those institutions when they start making large numbers of unconditional offers, it would appear that actually it doesn't really have an appreciable impact on the proportion of offers which are ultimately accepted and taken up by students.
Do we know why that is? I mean, off the top of my head, it would strike me that if I was giving an unconditional offer or given one, that might become a sort of insurance choice for me. I mean, I then have that in the bag and I can perhaps afford to be a bit more adventurous with my other offer, and if I get lucky, then I'm going to disregard that unconditional one pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's potentially part of it, but I think also it does suggest that perhaps students are more discerning than they're sometimes being given credit for, and what they will really attach importance to is the course and the university and, you know, the fit that is for them, and suggest that they may not be, you know, so easily seduced as you might think.
Yeah, does it do the reputation of the institution down, do you think, if they've said, well, we'll take you unconditionally? Does it sort of say, well, we're throwing caution to the wind here, you're through the doors, you know, don't worry too much about your academic sort of stripes, as it were?
Yeah, that's certainly a risk, and there's also other risks that, for example, in the, you know, last 6 months of your studies and the run-up to your exams, your A-level exams, that is, that students may take their foot off the pedal and, you know, ultimately, you know, would suffer at university as a result of that. I guess, seeing this is the first time that this analysis has been done, what will be interesting to see is whether the trend continues or whether it turns to be quite a short-lived phenomenon.
Interesting stuff. Well, you'll find that in our news section this week, as well as online, as ever, of course. John Morgan, I felt a bit guilty earlier. I said we were going to cover your piece on governance, and I suggested it might be quite a dry topic. Not that I doubt your ability to make dry topics absolutely fascinating on the page, but I was relieved a bit when I looked at the top line of your article, which says, governance, the word could lay claim to being one of the most boring in the English language. So you're obviously with me to some extent on this. It's very important, though, indeed. It's vital. It can make or break careers, make or break vice chancellor's positions. And you've been looking at the Committee of University Chairs guidance on governance for UK higher education.
That's right. Yes, set out expectations very low by admitting that governance is indeed boring at the start. But as you say, there's been a number of dramatic exits for vice chancellors this year after fallings out with their governing bodies. So it definitely should be high on the agenda in higher education. And what's happened recently is that the Committee of University Chairs, which is a rather little-known organisation that sort of represents the heads of governing bodies in the UK, has issued a new code of governance, which updates the old version originally published in 2004. And obviously, in light of those exits for vice-chancellors and the fact that we've seen the rise of a new higher education market, there are a few questions about whether the new code is sort of striking the right balance, because it broadly maintains the position of the old code, and you've still got this same system of self-regulation and sort of light touch guidance, critics would say. So what the broad outline of the new guidance is, we've got some changes on a couple of areas that have been very controversial in higher education, like vice chancellor's pay, where there's sort of new words on the fact that governing bodies should have a view to safeguarding public funds when they're setting VC's pay, and the fact that governing body decisions must be free from undue pressures from donors or corporate sponsors, probably an acknowledgement of what happened with the LSE and its links to the Gaddafi regime.
Yeah.
But then I spoke to Fernand von Pronsinsky, who led the review of higher education governance in Scotland.
He's the Vice Chancellor of Robert Gordon.
That's right. And he was sort of joined the contrast between what's happening in Scotland, where you've had a government commission review that's resulted in proposed legislation on university governance from the Scottish government that's going to probably lead to governing bodies including, you know, at least two student representatives and two elected staff members on governing bodies, and what's happening in England, where you don't really have that debate about student representation and staff representation in the bodies that run universities, and it's very hard to get any insight into how they make their decisions. Quite often they won't publish the minutes, and you might even struggle to get the minutes under FOI.
That's what we've found out. Yeah.
Whereas in Scotland, the von Pronsinsky review actually recommended that governing bodies should be meeting in public, although that recommendation hasn't actually been taken forward. So there's a really interesting contrast between Scotland and England.
Yeah, one or two universities in England did, I think, experiment with student representatives on board. And
there is student and staff representation, I'd say probably on most governing bodies, but there's no... Whereas in Scotland, there's going to be a requirement actually enshrined in legislation. In England, it's a lot more kind of down to the discretion of individual universities and the CUC code. It doesn't offer any kind of hard and fast rules. It just said there is an expectation that governing bodies will contain staff and student members.
Yeah. Well, page 18 and 19 for that analysis this week. That's all for this issue review. A little bit shorter this week. We thought we'd sort of gently welcome you into the new year. We'll be back next week with a brand new one. Until then, you can comment on anything we've discussed on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. You'll find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk as ever as well. But until next week, that's all for this THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.